He was a country music superstar for well over a decade, a guitar wizard with a voice that could melt chocolate, and 21 Grammys on the shelf. He's won more than any other male country artist, and number 22 might be on the way.
I've been hopping freight trains all my life. I woke up cold and hungry in the middle of the night. I've been on the wrong end of a drunkard's night, and nowhere to send the letters that I write.
This song you're hearing was just nominated, as I record this episode, for Best American Roots Song. And yet, when you listen to Vince Gill talk about his life in music, he's pure salt of the earth. It's no wonder hundreds of musicians have asked him to play and sing on their records.
I don't want to ride the rails no more. I want to know a woman's love worth dying.
That's what I love, the democracy of making music, in that it takes all those elements that most people aren't even aware of. And that's fine. Some people just listen to music and they focus on the guy up there singing, but I'm listening to the bass player, I'm listening to the drummer, I'm listening to what the guitar player plays, and I love every note of it. That's, to me, what's beautiful about collaborating with people, is that all the notes are equal, and it takes all those notes to make something great.
Vince Gill is the subject of today's episode of What It Takes, a podcast about passion, vision, and perseverance from the Academy of Achievement. What a great way to usher in the new year. I'm your host, Alice Winkler.
Adam A., this child is gifted. And I heard that enough that I started to believe it.
If you have the opportunity, not a perfect opportunity, and you don't take it, you may never have another chance.
It all was so clear. It was just like the picture started to form itself.
There was no way in which a lie could prevail over the truth. Darkness over light, death over life.
Every day I wake up and decide, today I'm going to love my life. Decide.
My advice is, if they're going to break your leg once when you go in that place, stay out of there.
And then along come these differential experiences that you don't look for, you don't plan for, but boy, you better not miss them.
The list of musicians who've played with Vince Gill is ridiculously long. I wouldn't even know where to start, but I will tell you this story. When Glenn Frey, a founding member of the Eagles, died unexpectedly in 2016, the band called Vince Gill. He was a country icon, but he could play anything and everything. Gill had been close with Glenn Frey, and he liked the idea of helping keep his friend's songs alive, so he said yes. It was also a new music opportunity, and that's all Vince Gill has ever been after, as you'll hear in this interview with the Academy of Achievement, recorded at the 2009 International Summit in South Africa. So for the past 3 years, when this Country Music Hall of Famer isn't headlining his own shows, you can find him touring the world, playing rock and roll as an eagle.
I like the way sparkling earrings lay against your skin so brown. I want to sleep with you in the desert tonight, with a million stars all around.
Sing it.
I feel a peaceful, easy feeling. I know you won't let me down, 'cause I'm already standing on the ground.
Vince Gill can't remember when he first picked up a guitar, but he's seen pictures of himself at the age of 2 dragging around a little parlor guitar that belonged to his dad.
I don't have a conscious memory of when I started, but all I know is it's all I've ever done. And I got my own guitar when I was 10 years old. And that was, I can still remember finding that gift under the tree. And what an amazing, you know, I didn't know it at the time, but it was easily the most incredible Christmas gift I ever got, more than a football or more than any of that other kind of stuff, you know, because at the time, being a 10-year-old kid, my folks scrimped and saved, and they actually took that old tenor guitar of mine and traded it in on this new electric Gibson guitar called an ES-335. And at 10 years old, the fact that my folks got me something that grand and that great and so playable, that it was inspiring, you know, even at 10 years old. And I still have that guitar today. And as it turned out, it wound up being a guitar I would have sought as a grown, matured player because of the type of instrument it is. You know, there are a lot of great guitar players that play a 335.
Chuck Berry, Eric Clapton, and B.B. King, to name just a few. It is a distinctive shape and is neither fully hollow nor fully solid. Vince Gill didn't realize the significance of the 335 when he was 10. He just felt motivated to play it. He also spent some time learning violin, even playing in the school orchestra. But it just took one mean violin teacher to drive him away from classical and into the ever-loving arms of country. He loved country music and rock and roll growing up in Oklahoma, way more than school.
As I look back, I really feel like that records were my books, you know, and I would study the, you know, it was back in the day when the albums were large, you could read the credits, you knew who played on things, you know, who wrote the songs, who sang on things, and I was one of those kids that loved all the information on a record. I spent years buying records of artists I'd never heard of, just because I knew the guitar player. Or I knew somebody that played a certain instrument that I said, well, if this guy played on this record, maybe there's something good in there because I like that musician. So I felt like those records told me stories in a way that related to me more because my brain was stimulated by sounds more than sights, I think. And I loved listening to records and trying to emulate what I was hearing. You know, I'm self-taught and all by ear and all, you know, just by hearing it come through the speakers. And I said, how'd they do that? And just sit and practice and noodle and mess around till I made the same sounds.
He did take a few guitar lessons in junior high, but he mainly learned songs from his teacher and absolutely no music theory.
I wish I'd have stayed with the violin lessons, the piano lessons, to where I could have learned the theory on paper of music so I could be able to read, you know, as I don't read music, you know. I can kind of go through there and remember the very rudimentary things of, you know, of how the notes are and what they are, but I couldn't sight read and play what I was reading. So that's all I know about that. Sounded like Forrest Gump, didn't I?
So if there wasn't an inspiring teacher in this tale, who did challenge him and open up the possibility of spending his life playing music?
All those musicians did. You know, they were countless. You know, I had my favorite records. I loved Chet Atkins and I loved the Beatles and I loved the people that I loved, but just that element of collaboration, of people gathering together and playing music. I saw it as a kid, didn't realize it, you know, because my mom played a little bit. She played the harmonica, and she'd play 2 or 3 songs and run out of breath, and she was done. And my dad played the banjo and the guitar, and he had some friends, and they had a little band that would occasionally go play at a an outdoor thing, or, you know, not professionally, but always just for fun. And I always got to play along, and just being around musicians was, to me, the neatest thing. You know, I had garage bands, you know, where you found two or three guys in school that played, hey, let's start a band, you know, and away we went. We'd go in the garage and bash away. And I still work with a kid that I grew up with since seventh grade. We started playing music together when we got in junior high school, and we're still together. He works with me and travels on the road and takes care of all my guitars. And I called him when I had a couple of big hits. I said, hey, you want to go on this ride with me? And he goes, yeah, sure, why not?
When Vince Gill told his parents he was hitting the road as a musician, they weren't the least bit fazed and never tried to dissuade him.
Oh, I think they knew early on that was the only thing that was in store for me. You know, I was a decent golfer and played on the high school golf team, and I went through high school and I played out a lot. My mom and dad were not real strict in the fact that they would let me go play in bars, you know, while I was in high school in different bands. And I said, you get to school and get your grade, keep your grades up, and, you know, don't give us any reason to not let you. And so I tried to be respectful of all of that. And so I had so many years under my belt, even when I was a freshman, junior, and all through high school, that I was out playing gigs and traveling around some with bands and to different parts of the states. And I think they saw the writing on the wall, and they weren't surprised when I didn't really have a plan to go to college when I got out of high school. And I wouldn't advise that for anybody. You know, it just worked for me. And somebody called me when I was 18 and said, hey, you want to come be in this band in Kentucky? And I said, sure. So I packed up everything and I moved there and started playing with that band for a while. That led to another band. And then I moved to California, and that led to another band. And everything that happened to me was a result of just going and trying to get better, of trying to always play with better musicians. And I got to spend a lot of years really putting my feet in a lot of different places. I sang on so many records in that stretch of time in Nashville in the 80s. I don't know how many artist records I've worked on over the years. I know it's well over 400 or 500, something like that. And not that that's bragging, but it's how I made a living. You know, people thought enough of what I did as a supporting cast member to be a part of those records. And I didn't have goals. I didn't have dreams of stardom. I wasn't saying I have to be famous. I just said, I'm having the best time playing music. And even saying it today, I would have been fine had that been my career, you know, because I didn't have to be at the center of it to have it matter. I just had to be a part of it. And my folks saw that. And so they never said, when are you going to go get a real job? Because I had really put a lot of effort into it long before it was time to move on and think about something else. And I think that's another reason maybe a lot of young musicians fall by the wayside. They're not willing to do what I did. Which is go out there and, you know, play on street corners once in a while to make enough money to pay your rent and be willing to starve. You know, they always want that safety net. They want that cushion. And I never needed it, you know. And I don't feel any different today than I did at 18, you know. And what's in the bank account has never changed one ounce of what I love doing. You know, I'd still play in those same beer joints. And I think that's the objective of my mother and father, in a sense that as I talk to my mom these days, she said, well, you know what? I think my job as being your parent was to make you be a happy person. That to me is what parenting is. And so that was, to me, she said, I feel like I've done a good job because he's getting to do what he loves and he's happy doing it. And he doesn't seem to care that he's, you know, struggling to pay the rent most of the time. So why should I worry? He's a happy boy.
Well, Jennifer was 17, the same age as I. Well, I had lived next door to her ever since I was 5. Oh, she knew I loved her dearly, for I told her many times.
Let's return here for a moment to the band that lured this teenage boy from Oklahoma City to Louisville, Kentucky. That band was called the Bluegrass Alliance. In the 1970s, it was really well known in the bluegrass world, and a lot of great musicians had gone through the band. So for Vince Gill, it was a big opportunity and a big step up.
Down by the waterfall.
I didn't know anything. You know, I knew I had all the stuff that I owned in my van, you know, a guitar and a few t-shirts and my golf clubs and whatever I had. And I went off to Kentucky, you know, playing this band and found a little place to live. And my rent was $15 a month and stayed in an attic in this old cool house in Cherokee Park and a house full of musicians that all loved bluegrass music. And you know, I just followed my muse.
He got to travel around the United States and play a lot of festivals, and he described it as a joyful, innocent time.
I think one of my favorite memories of those days was I ran out of clean clothes. And obviously my mom's not around. You always washed my jeans and my t-shirts, you know, and I had this pile of dirty laundry. I said, now what do I do? So I went to a laundromat and I started watching people. I said, okay, they put those in there and they put all the white stuff in there and they kind of put the money in and dump that stuff on top. And I figured out how to wash my clothes and figured out how to dry them. Then they were all dry and I said, how do you fold them? You know? And this woman was over there just laughing her head off. She's going, you don't know how to fold your clothes, do you? I said, no, ma'am. I've never done my laundry before. She goes, well, God bless your mother, but come here. I'm going to teach you how to fold your shirts. And I still fold my t-shirts that way today, you know. So you just, you know, life's about stepping in there and learning and making mistakes. And you're not ever going to learn anything if you don't make a mistake. That's where you find the real beauty in life is screwing something up and learning from it. And I did it plenty. And I moved from there to Southern California, a 19-year-old kid, and I moved to Los Angeles to play bluegrass music, you know, and be in this great band. And it was a great time in Southern California. The music scene there was unbelievable. And the first gig that I did with the band that I had joined was in a club there called the Troubadour in L.A., and it's like one of the most famous clubs in history. We opened for a guy named Guy Clark, who's a great singer-songwriter from Texas. And I walked into this gig, and I couldn't believe who was there. You know, it was all the people that I was aspiring to be like, Emmylou Harris, Rodney Crowell, all these guys that were all playing with Guy and there, and I think Linda Ronstadt was there that night. And I couldn't believe it. You know, I said, here are all these people that I've seen on the backs of these records that I've studied my whole life. And there they were, and I made friends, and, you know, they heard me play, they heard me sing, and that just kind of was another rung in the ladder, so to speak, you know, of just getting out there and jumping in the middle of the water and see how deep it is.
He spent several years in Southern California doing session work, playing guitar and singing backup vocals on other people's records. And that led to 3 years as a member of the band Pure Prairie League. They had a major label record deal, so that was exciting. And if you lived through the 70s, for sure you know this song, whether or not you realized that the lead vocalist on it was Vince Gill.
Oh, I tried to find, thinking just the other day, something that would ease her mind, something that I meant to say to her. Falling in and out loud with you,
But 3 years with Pure Prairie League was long enough. Vince Gill was ready to move on, and eventually he landed with Roseanne Cash.
If I could only learn to make you love me, I'd make you love me like I love you. If I could give you what I want to give you, I'd want to give you a heart that's true.
Roseanne was having big hits, and I was her guitar player, and it was kind of a great job to have for a guitar player, because it featured the guitar a lot. And the people that played before me were James Burton and Albert Lee, arguably two of the greatest guitar players that ever lived. James played with Elvis for years, and you know, so I was occupying this pretty heavy seat, you know, for a guitar player.
One of the guys in Roseanne Cash's band was Tony Brown, a pianist who used to play with Elvis Presley. But he was also an A&R guy for RCA Records in Nashville. That's a person who, at least in the old record label system, scouted talent, brought in new recording artists, and oversaw their first recordings.
And he said, man, you need to start making country records.
And so Tony Brown signed Vince Gill to RCA in 1983, and helped him make his first record.
And not much happened. I made my second record, not much happened. I made my third record, and not much happened. And then I got another chance. I moved over to MCA Records a few years later and got another opportunity. And, you know, and I really am grateful for the years of struggle. In looking back, it was a humbling experience. It was a learning experience. I think at the time it was hard, because you feel like you're beating your head against the wall and say, why isn't this working? You know, and say, well, maybe if you go around the wall, you know. So I found some way to go around the wall.
And one of the keys, Vince Gill says, was that he wasn't ever afraid of failure.
I wasn't. You know, I didn't know any better. I mean, there's probably some beauty in that, you know. All I knew was that I didn't need much. That felt good to me, because to me, progress was not how much more money I could make, but how much better I could be. Who am I playing with? Am I playing with better musicians? Yes. There was one point when I was in my early 20s, I'd spent a few years playing with Pure Prairie League and had a few hit records and was on television shows and was the front man. I was the lead singer, and I quit to go be a sideman in one of my favorite musician and songwriter singers, a guy named Rodney Crowell, to just be his guitar player, harmony singer. I said, what are you doing? You were the guy in the front. And I go, yeah, but this band's better. These songs are better. To me it was a move up. It didn't, to most people it wouldn't look like that. But I knew in my heart, and my ears told me, this is a better thing. Years later, I was invited by Mark Knopfler to join Dire Straits. And it was at a time where I, you know, was pretty broke. You know, I was really struggling. I'd had a record deal for several years, but couldn't turn that into hit records and couldn't turn that into a big career. And even though I was trying, and this would have been a very lucrative, great move financially and in a lot of ways. Musically, it would have been a great move. But I said, I can't do it right now. I said, I just changed record companies, and I've invested a lot of my life in country music. And I said, I don't want to bail on it, because I think I have something to offer it. And, you know, that was like, here was the golden egg being dangled in front of me, and I turned it down. And I was lucky, you know, because then the next record I had was this massive hit, and it completely turned my life around. And so I made a decision based on my heart, and it didn't let me down very often.
I rushed home from work like I always do. I spend my whole day just thinking of you. When I
my whole life was changed. 'Cause nobody answered when I called your name. A note on the table that told me goodbye. Said you'd grown weary of living a lie. Oh, your love has ended, but mine still remains. But nobody answers when I call.
Turned out it was the right song at the right time, and that was a song called When I Call Your Name, and there was just something about it that struck that chord. One thing I was grateful for, that it was a really traditional country record. You know, I really like deep-rooted, hardcore, twangy, you know, that kind of country music, the old school stuff. I don't like the new stuff very much, and the contemporary side of it's okay, and I've done some of it, but I'm not as crazy about it as I am those great old records of the 50s and 60s that I grew up on, and to me is the definition of what country music is. But the two elements that to me made it much more special than it was were the piano player, a fellow named Barry Beckett, played all that Muscle Shoals stuff and produced a bunch of great records, and he was a dear friend of mine, and he came in late one night and played the intro, and it's lonesome, and it's, and as soon as it happens, you know what record it is. And that's another thing that why I love being a part of making records, is because the musicians oftentimes define records, make them memorable. They play something before the singer ever starts singing that gives it its definition and its identity. And they never get the credit, near enough credit for it, but they deserve it. And that's what Barry Beckett did as a piano player to that record. That happened late one night. We called him, said, you know, it was like 2 a.m, said, hey, we need a really cool intro on this song we're working on. He'd been a friend of mine for years, and he came in and played and left. And my favorite part of that story was, after it had become a hit, he came to the party. We had a big party that I finally had a hit record. And he hugged me and said, man, I'm so proud of you. I think that's so great. You deserve it. And long time coming. And he says, by the way, who played piano on it? And I said, are you kidding me? He goes, no, that intro. I go, well, it's you. He goes, oh, well, no wonder I liked it. And he had forgotten that he did it, you know, because he does so many things, and it's hard to remember them all. And so that's an element to me that made that song much better than the song was in its original state, you know, of a guy playing a song and Patti Loveless sang the harmony. And she has this aching, beautiful, crystal Kentucky voice that is one of the greatest things I've ever heard. And I thought, you know, we sound really good together on her records. I wonder how it'll sound with her on my record. And so I called her and asked her if she'd come sing on it. And the first line of harmony that she sang, I just looked at Tony and he looked at me, and we both got chills on our arms.
Oh, the lonely sound of my voice calling is driving me insane. Just like rain, the tears keep falling, but nobody answers when I call your name. Oh, nobody answers when I call your name.
And that's as big a reason as that song was a hit, you know, for all those reasons. It had so many great elements. I have an old friend that used to say, great songs play themselves. You know, just get out of the way.
2 years after that breakout hit, Vince Gill had his first number one single, I Still Believe in You. It won the Grammy for Best Country Song that year.
Well, everybody wants a little piece of my time. Still I put you at the end of the line. Oh, how it breaks my heart to cause you this pain, to see the tears you cry falling like rain. Give me the chance to prove, and I'll make
as they say, the hits just kept on coming, and the trophies kept piling up, Grammys and Country Music Awards. Meanwhile, Vince Gill also became the host of the Country Music Awards.
They called and asked if I would co-host the Country Music Awards with Reba, and we were great friends, and we had just had a semi-hit with a duet together, and I said, yeah, I'd love to, you know. I had no expectation of being a great host. And I enjoyed it, and it went really well, and I won an award that night, I think, or two, and so it was a win-win for me, and everybody liked it, and they asked me to do it the next year, and the next, and the next, and I did it for 12 years. And I promised myself, I said, man, if I ever walk out there, and I'm hosting this show, and I get this vibe from the people of, oh, God, not him again, you know, I said, and then I want to quit. And as it turned out, I was the one that walked out and went, oh, God, not me again. And I had just kind of grown tired of it. And I just said, people, I have a feeling people are seeing me more as the host guy than that musician that burns inside of me and that artist that burns inside of me. I don't want to be that guy. I'd rather be this guy. I needed to honor the musician in me a little more.
He may have gotten tired of hosting the awards, but here's how he described his feelings about winning them.
If you're the guy winning the awards, you think they're the greatest things in the world. If you're not winning them, you think the guy winning them is not any good. You know, it's pretty true. But I hope and believe that in the majority of cases, it's a result of the work. Fame was interesting for me. In that your anonymity was gone, you know, and that's, be careful what you wish for. And I think I spoke earlier about the years of struggle were a great learning curve for me. as I watched people react to success. Some reacted favorably, some reacted, I thought, poorly. And I saw enough of it to go, I know I don't want to act like that. I don't like arrogance. I don't like the guy beating on his chest that just scored the touchdown. Look at me, look at me, look at me. I like being just, you know, one of the flowers in the vase, you know. I don't enjoy a lot of attention. I basically ignored it in a sense that I wasn't going to let it change who I was. And I wanted to still go to the grocery store. I wanted to go to movie. I wanted to do everything I ever did. And I just, you know, whatever the consequences are for doing that, I'm okay with. Somebody wants a picture. Somebody wants an autograph. That's no big deal. And I married a woman that is the same. And that's been a great gift because she could care less how successful she's been.
Vince Gill's wife is the multi-talented, multi-award-winning gospel and Christian rock singer, Amy Grant.
She's the same always. She's constant in that she's kind of oblivious to it in a beautiful way. And I try to be too.
True love.
I've always felt like that God blessed me with some great gifts. I realize those are God-given and they're special. But the difference being is that doesn't make me special. It's only the gift that is special.
One of the gifts Vince Gill treasures is his songwriting. But calling it a gift doesn't mean it necessarily came naturally. He worked at it and developed it, largely with the help of two men he feels indebted to.
Tony Brown and Emory Gordy were two great musicians. Both have had stellar careers as record producers, as session musicians, and two of the best friends I'd ever made. And they, along with folks like Guy Clark, Rodney Crowell, they taught me what great songwriters were all about. They knew the value of a good song. You know, they believed in me as a songwriter, which was a great gift, you know. And living in a world like Nashville where, you know, there's guys parking your car that can write better songs than you sometimes. It's a great town, and it's a song town, you know. That's really what it is. And because I didn't go to college, because I was not maybe an English major or a lot of reasons that my vocabulary doesn't have the depth. I still have a way to communicate. Hank Williams used to write songs that were simple, but there was great beauty in their simpleness. And to me, great songwriters tell stories where you hear those words and you see the pictures. The songwriters are like painters. I've always, music's in my ears. It's not in my eyes. And so that's what I'm always trying to accomplish is to get you to close your eyes and see in your own mind, in your own heart, what these words mean to you. I think that's the beauty of the written word. So as simplistic as songs are sometimes, you know, there's a great beauty in them.
I know your life on earth was troubled. Only you could know the pain. You weren't afraid to face the devil. You were no stranger.
It's an incredible feeling, he says, to experience the crowd being moved by one of his songs when he's playing a concert. But one thing Vince Gill has learned in his many decades on the road is that no two crowds are the same.
Every single one of them is different. It took me years to realize that if you play in Texas and they don't dance, they don't like you. You know, when you play in the beer joints in Texas, if they're dancing, they like you. They don't applaud, but they dance. The best feeling I've ever had in my life playing for 40 years in front of people now is in Ireland. And they didn't know my music that well there, but there's something about music in that country that it goes deeper. It means more. It has more depth. And I'll never, ever forget that. That reaction was spiritual. It's the best feeling in the world when you're playing and people are listening and then they show their appreciation. That's the only way you know, really, how you're getting on.
Of course, Vince Gill says there are as many kinds of gigs as there are audiences. And he should know, he's been on stage with more artists than he can remember.
I've done every conceivable kind of gig there is. There's nothing that's going to surprise me anymore. I've been the opening act. I've been the middle act. I've been the headliner. I've been the act that nobody's ever heard of. I got booked in a gig one time at a college during spring break. Nobody came. you just have to have a great tolerance, you know? And the older you get, now it's like before I'd go out and I go, oh, I'd be real disappointed that more people didn't come. Now I go out and I go, somebody came. Yippee. You know, and your perspective changes. One instance really stands out. I was playing in Pure Prairie League, and one of my heroes opened for us. It was Larry Carlton. He's a guitar player that most people aren't going to know. Not a household name, but played on Steely Dan records and was one of the greatest session players in Los Angeles and a brilliant guitar player, one of my favorites of all time. And I went up to him afterwards and I go, man, this is wrong. You're one of the greatest guitar players ever, and there's no way that you should have opened for us. And he goes, man, it doesn't matter where you play. Just play. That was great advice to get as a kid, you know?
And still, almost exactly 40 years later, those are words Vince Gill lives by. The superstardom was great, but...
That wasn't what I was after. I long to be called on the phone, hey, will you come sing on my record? Hey, will you come play on my record? Yeah, I'd love to. Because that's what I think has been the most fun, even more so than my own success as an artist, was the diversity and the collaborating that I got to do because I was willing. You know, most people, they don't want to do that. They don't have any interest in it. And I just love the fact that the phone would ring and there who would be on the other end sometimes, you know. Eric Clapton called one time and I answered the phone. He goes, Vince, it's Eric Clapton. I go, yeah, sure. Who's yanking my chain, you know? And he said, no, seriously, I want you to come and play on a record of mine. I want to record one of your songs. And I was just going, oh, yes, this is all great. And you just never know who's going to be on the other end of that phone. And the beauty of all that is all of us, you know, we've got a healthy dose of insecurity in us, you know, and self-doubt. And I'm the king of self-deprecation of my, you know, I love to pick on me first, you know, it puts everybody else at ease. But in saying that we're all a little bit insecure, I'm in New York, Eric is recording one of my songs, I'm scared to death, you know. And for the reason that I'm going, okay, I'm not afraid to play, but I'm afraid that he has such a great gift for sounding great. His tone is always like unbelievably great. I said, so my fear is my tone won't be great. I know I can play, but it has to sound great. So I'm insecure and I'm scared. And we've been tracking for a few hours and having a lot of fun. And he's playing electric guitar and I'm playing acoustic guitar, and I'm great because I got a little part that's working and fitting right in there, and I'm comfortable and not really beating myself up too bad. And he says, all right, Vince, you play electric this time, and I'll play acoustic. And I went, oh, well, why would you want to do that? You have just completely obliterated this song and torched it into the dirt. You know, it's so good. And I didn't really, you know, and that didn't last too long. So he said, we'll both play electric, you know. So we started tracking again, and we had a take that we liked, and we were listening to it. And it was just him, myself, and the engineer sitting in the control booth. And here, arguably, one of the greatest guitar players that ever lived, in Eric Clapton, is sitting behind the board. I'm sitting over there on the other side of the board on the couch, and I'm looking over between the speakers, and he's playing. He played something. I went, oh, God, that sounds so good. That's so great, you know. And I played something, and I'm sitting there thinking, oh, man, my tone is just sounds small compared to Eric. And right at that moment, Eric says, has his guitar got reverb on it? The engineer said, no. And he goes, make mine sound that good. I'm just going, I give up. You know, we're all the same. And it was a great, once again, there was a neat lesson in that. Even though here's the arguably the greatest of the great, he still got a few insecurity issues like the rest of us. Very comforting.
One day I believe one day I can't see maybe out in the country, maybe down by the sea. I'm gonna wake up one morning and find out I've been set free. One day
to me, I've always been a reactor to life and not a planner and a worker trying to accomplish something. I just want it to all happen naturally. You know, and that feels the best to me, because I just think that music is something that doesn't have an answer, in a sense. It's just this thing that you listen to and you either like it or you don't. It's not like a ball game where it's over and you know who won. And I am so grateful that I am not hung up on the results of what something has done to define it for me. You know, the definition is in the work, hands down. And once that work is done, you know, I have finished it and done it to the best of my ability. Whether it sells 10 copies or 10 million, that doesn't change one note of that work.
Vince Gill. He spoke to the Academy of Achievement at the International Summit in South Africa. His latest album, released in 2019 at the age of 62, is his most personal to date. It's called Oki. We heard the Grammy-nominated song from it a little earlier, but we'll go out with one more song from the album. Happy New Year, everyone, and thanks for listening. I'm Alice Winkler, and this is What It Takes from the Academy of Achievement.
Oh, I've written down the memories of these 60-some odd years, trying hard to just say thank you as I wipe away the tears. I hear my grandson calling, so I guess I better.
What It Takes is made possible with generous funding from the Catherine B. Reynolds Foundation.
Oh, I finished up the letter, put it down in black and white. No phone call wouldn't cut it, not the way I feel tonight. Letter to